in his old book now, I'm going to see an interpretation.
So these are terribly intimidating, aren't they? So, phenomenology then. What's phenomenology? Theory of appearances. Phenomena is appearances. So phenomenology is the logos of a phenomena, the theory of appearances. And although the term goes back quite a long way, and indeed Hegel wrote a Phenomenology of the Spirit, in which he talked about the spirit moving through history, and the working out of the spirit through history is phenomenology. The sense that I'm going to use it is mainly developed in 20th century philosophy with this philosopher Edmund Husserl, who you're probably familiar with. And Husserl, he's a German philosopher. He thinks philosophy has been dogged by the problem of what he called idealism and or materialism, that the world is purely made of consciousness, as it were. You can't give an account independently of the mind. It's a kind of Hegelian view or a Barclayan view, versus an account that the material world is real, and that consciousness and the mind is a kind of epiphenomenon of the material world. So that he's got these two problems that he's trying to get around. And he says, okay, let's get around this problem by saying that avoid the problem altogether of objectivity or non-objectivity, and say let's just take appearances to consciousness as truth, as what we have to go on. So any appearance to human consciousness becomes the legitimate object of inquiry without asking the question of its validity or truth. So he wanted to suspend judgments of the validity or truth behind appearances. And so he developed this phenomenology as a means of doing that. And he was very prolific. He wrote a vast number of texts, most of which still remain unedited and unpublished in Belgium. But he did publish some material during his lifetime. And he's most famous, of course, for being the teacher of Heidegger. And so let's look at some of his main ideas in just sort of 10, 15 minutes or so. Perhaps the most important idea of phenomenology is intentionality. Now, when I say intentionality, your intention is to go for a cup of coffee or something, or to fix the bike, feed the cat. Those are intentions. But by intentionality, phenomenology means that consciousness always has an object. There's always an object of consciousness. Consciousness has a subject and an object. According to phenomenology, you can never have a consciousness without an object. It always has an object. You can never have consciousness without an object. Buddhism might come along and say, well, yes, you can. You can have nothing as an object of consciousness. Phenomenology would say, well, if you've got nothing as an object of consciousness, then you wouldn't be conscious. You'd be unconscious. So you're always thinking of something. It's always consciousness of is always the key thing. And intentionality, that came from a 19th century philosopher and psychologist, really, called Brentano. And he coined this term intentionality. It's very interesting. In Brentano's lectures, you've got Husserl sitting there taking notes, and you've got Freud sitting in the same lectures on intentionality. And then out of Husserl comes Heidegger. I can never spell Heidegger. It's got a million D's and E's and G's in it. And then you've got Jung comes out of Freud, as it were. And they're both Jung and Freud doesn't use the term phenomenology, but both Jung, Heidegger and Husserl use the term phenomenology. But they never refer to each other. So Husserl is concerned, and Heidegger is concerned with consciousness, really, and awareness. And Freud is concerned with the unconscious. And I think it's quite interesting that you've got that pattern there. And both are sitting in Brentano's lectures. So Brentano, I think, is often underestimated and a very important figure. Okay, so intentionality, then, is derived but developed by Husserl. Consciousness has an object, is it with consciousness of something? And he calls this the cogito which is the I think, which he's getting from Descartes. If you remember Descartes, I think, therefore I am. The I think is the indubitable element of the world. What cannot be doubted is the I think for Descartes. Everything you can doubt, first year philosophy, you've probably all done this, you can doubt everything in the world except that, except the statement I think for Descartes. And so Husserl is picking up on that I think, but he says the I think always has an object. There's always an object of consciousness. The cogito, the I think, has a cogitatum, an object of consciousness. Or what he referred to as the cogitationes, the flow of consciousness, the flow of awareness. And so you can have a cogitatum or a flow of cogitationes, and these cogitationes are appearances to consciousness, they're the objects of consciousness and our appearances. So he wanted to study appearances to consciousness. So anything that potentially anything that occurs within the flow of the cogitationes is open to, for Husserl, to critical and scientific investigation. So he thought phenomenology was a science, and that we could inquire into any appearance to consciousness. So if you're in love, if you're in pain, as well as rational thinking, all these are appearances to consciousness. And so phenomenology opens up a whole realm of inquiry. And people like Max Scheler looked at the emotions and love, and sociologists looked at social sociological forms as appearances, and provinces of meaning. You get the idea of developing that there are different provinces of meaning in which different kinds of inquiry can operate in these different provinces of meaning. Okay, so you've got a cogito, the subject, and you've got the object of consciousness. Now, the object of consciousness, Husserl also referred to as noema, the object of knowledge, the noema. And the noesis is the, what he called the noesis, is the way in which the object is known. So consciousness knows an object, a noema, and it knows the object through a certain method, and that method he called the noesis. That he just used his Latin, these terms. It's Greek, isn't it? Not Latin. Greek terms. Cogito is Latin. Okay, so that's the first thing. Are you happy with that, everyone? Consciousness is intentional. You might not agree with it, but this is what the first claim of phenomenology. Consciousness is intentional. Secondly, Husserl introduced the notion of bracketing, what he called the epoche, Greek word, bracketing, the epoche, bracketing. And he called this the first phenomenological reduction. And what is bracketing? Bracketing means that you put brackets around the question of the objectivity or the truth behind appearances. You suspend judgment. No, not suspend judgment. You suspend the question of the objectivity behind appearances. So here you've got, you think of a green unicorn. You meet some guy in the street. Some guy came up to me babbling away the other day, and it was incomprehensible what he was saying. But he could have been saying, "Oh, I saw a green unicorn flying through the air," for example. And if you apply the phenomenological reduction, you bracket the question of the truth of the claim, because what you have is an appearance to consciousness. You have the claim itself. I saw a green unicorn flying through the air. So you suspend judgment about the objectivity or the truth behind the appearance. And that's fundamental to phenomenology. So therefore, phenomenology becomes a fundamentally descriptive enterprise. It's primarily descriptive. So you're mapping out, you're describing appearances to consciousness. And any appearance to consciousness is worthy of inquiry and demands inquiry. Now, in religious studies circles, often bracketing epoche gets confused, and you read texts that say that bracketing is the suspension of subjectivity, or bracketing is the suspension of belief, and which is fundamentally incoherent, particularly with regard to phenomenology. Because how can you suspend subjectivity? Because subjectivity is the heart of phenomenology, in the sense that it's the subject of consciousness, always has an object of consciousness. So you don't suspend the question of the truth of the subject, you suspend the question of the truth of the object of appearance, behind the truth behind appearances, the objectivity behind appearances. The subject itself, as Husserl says, is not subject to the epoche. The subject of consciousness is not... The cogito is not subject to the epoche. It's the objects of consciousness that are subject to the epoche. So some religious studies texts talk about the suspending of subjectivity as a fundamental misunderstanding of epoche. Now, why do you want to do that? You want to do that for Husserl, to get around the question of the truth of or falsity of appearances, to get around that question. So you don't have to make claims about whether the green unicorn is true or not, but you can try to map and describe it accurately as you can. Okay, so that's the second, that's probably the most important part of phenomenology, is the bracketing, which means phenomenology is descriptive. There was a later stage of phenomenology that Husserl started to articulate called genetic phenomenology, in which he's trying to go beyond description and look at the origins and the sources of appearances. And he even mentions God on two occasions as the horizon of possibility for appearance, instead of consciousness, but he doesn't develop any of that. Okay, the next stage then is a second kind of reduction, and he called this the eidetic reduction, or if you're German, pronounce it eidetic, from eidos, the Greek word for idea. And okay, what's that? Okay, you've done your first bracketing, you've suspended the question of judgment behind appearances, and you've described all these appearances to consciousness, and then there's a further account in which you intuit the essence of the appearances to consciousness. What does that mean, intuit the essence? Husserl thought that all appearances had an essential element that you could understand, and he called this the eidetic, the reduction to the eidos, to the essence of the appearance. So, for example, in a book called The Cartesian Meditations, he uses the example of a house. You're living in a house, and like this building, we're aware of this room, but we're not aware of the totality of the house. But the more we explore the house, the building, the more we can intuit the essence of the house. I don't think he ever thought there was an end to this process. So you know that we experience this room, but for some of you who've never been here before, if I show you, I gave you a tour, your intuition of the essence of the house will become fuller the more you perceive of it. So likewise with all appearances, that's what he thought you could do. You could perform this eidetic reduction, this reduction to essences. And this has been, he was severely criticised for this by later phenomenologists, because they thought this was pure Platonism. This was Plato's ideas, some abstract essence. He denied it, but I can see why people thought that. And you call this intuition, the intuition of essence. Now, linked to the intuition of essence is the construction of typology. So you get, having intuited the essences, you can then construct different types of appearance, different, you can put descriptions that are different kind of categories or different types. So in religious sphere, you get types of religion. You get monistic religion and non-dualistic religion, and all that kind of terminology comes out of attempts to create typologies of religions. And that in turn comes from the phenomenological process. You're right so far. Why did he use the word intuition? Einfühlung, feeling in. Because he thought it was a process that was almost transrational, in a sense, the intuition of essence. Yeah, but certainly that was very. It was thinking, but it's all. But it was. How do you get? Yeah, you intuit the essence. It's almost. I mean, the description. The level of description is almost you can't never end it in a sense. As you can describe the Borges story of how you can never. The room is inexhaustible that we're in its description, the potential for description. But nevertheless, you underneath that. Those appearances, there is an essence, thought herself, that you could understand through this kind of direct perception, direct intuition of it, which he called this reduction, the eidetic reduction, the eidos. And then, now also he's careful to distinguish the eidos from the truth. He didn't mean that to be the reality or the truth of the thing, but is a deeper level of appearance, I suppose. And then there's a third phenomenological reduction, is the reduction, the transcendental reduction, what he called the transcendental reduction, which is the reduction to the self, what he called the transcendental ego, which is irreducible. So the intuition of essences. Okay, you've got the intuition of essence of objects. Now, the intuition of essence of the self is the transcendental reduction. It's pure reflexivity, in which the self understands itself as a pure subject. And that he called the transcendental reduction, that which it cannot be reduced any further. Pure subjectivity. And, of course, the later phenomenologist severely criticised herself for this. This transcendental reduction. This is Platonic. This is pure soul or something. So Merleau-Ponty comes along and says, "Okay, let's just stick with the bracketing and the first phenomenological reduction." Heidegger comes along and criticizes the whole notion of subjectivity. No, it's not subjectivity that's important, but being in the world is primary. Dasein, being there. And phenomenology becomes letting be seen that which shows itself, that which appears to you. So there are continuities between Husserl and Heidegger, but there are, you know, disruptions and so on. So phenomenology then is, I take primarily in the Husserlian sense, to be intentionality, bracketing, the eidetic reduction and the transcendental reduction, especially bracketing the first one, the epoche.
Sorry, for the transcendental reduction, is that just basically saying that the subject and object are one and the same?
No, I think he's saying that. No, he's not saying that. I think he's saying that there's. This is one reading. You've got the subject, you've got the cogito, and you've got the cogitatum, the subject and the object of consciousness. And this is the subjectivity usually sees itself through the object. Consciousness is conscious of something, and that's how consciousness becomes aware of itself, through being aware of an object. And the transcendental reduction is the transcendental ego is somehow behind that subject almost, and that rather than an intuition of the essence, it's almost like an intuition of the self, without an object almost. So I asked somebody once, they disagreed, an American scholar, Jamie Freer, and I said, is it like the transcendental, but here you've got the transcendental ego, and then the object of the transcendental ego is the subject and object, and she didn't think that, and I can't see that either actually on reading herself. So the transcendental ego is a deeper level of subjectivity which is directly intuited outside of an object. That's what I mean. Does that make sense to you?
Doesn't that contradict the idea of intentionality if there's no object?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so the object, this is consciousness, always consciousness of something. Yeah, except when it's consciousness of itself. Yeah, I think that's why Merleau-Ponty criticised him, because how can you have a transcendental ego, which indeed does contradict that very notion of intentionality. Yeah, that actually, when you think of it, it's fundamentally incoherent, isn't it? Transcendental ego is fundamentally incoherent.
Is it conscious, then?
It's the true self. It's the true subject of experience. Yeah, yeah. But I use the word ego. But is it not the subject of first person predicates? When you say I'm thirsty, I go and have a drink of water, I feed the cat. That's this level of description. It's not the transcendental ego speaking.
Having first been the consciousness is. Knows it exists because it's aware of something else.
Yeah.
Then it goes to the transcendental states that I am now able to be aware and becomes aware of being aware rather than forgets the object that it's aware.
Yeah, it's that kind of reflexivity, I suspect.
That's what I was looking at, that the object is not important anymore, just the being aware of being aware.
Being aware of being aware, yeah, yeah. There's almost a sense when you read Husserl about this, that it's almost like a timeless kind of state. It's almost like a outside of time. I mean, Merleau-Ponty said, well, what about body, he says, comes along and says, what about body? But you can have a phenomenology. You don't need the transcendental ego to have a phenomenology. You can simply have subjectivity and objectivity, and the subjectivity becomes self-aware through the object. This reflexivity through that, through becoming consciousness of the other. Of I and not I. I only becomes I because of not I. In that sense. The critique of phenomenology, there's problem of bracketing. Can the being of an appearance be separated from it? Derrida writes a book called Speech and Phenomena, in which he criticises the very notion, the foundation of phenomenology, is the bracketing idea, saying that you can't separate appearance from, I can't remember the argument, you have to go and look it up, I'm afraid, you can't separate the being of the appearance from the appearance, that the being of the appearance is, that's what a being is its appearance. Derrida. There's no being behind an appearance. That's what we have appearances. There's also a philosophical critique of the philosophy of consciousness from the Jewish philosopher Levinas, who says that Husserl is fundamentally wrong in being concerned with the subject, because what's important is the not-I, the object, an other which makes demands upon you, ethical demands upon you. So Husserl wasn't concerned with ethics, I don't think he wrote anything on ethics. So the first philosophy for Husserl, as for Descartes, is consciousness, the philosophy of consciousness. Levinas comes along and said, no, the primary position has to be otherness, has to be the injunction of the other makes ethical demands upon you. So ethics is first philosophy, not consciousness. And also that phenomenology is refuted from a position of what might be called the philosophy of the sign. That phrase, philosophy of the sign, was coined, I think, by a Russian literary theorist called Bakhtin. And that where you begin is not in consciousness, but you begin in signs, you begin in interrelationality. You begin with the philosophy of the sign, which we'll be looking at next week. And so consciousness, there's too much emphasis on consciousness. And that's not where you begin. You don't begin with subjectivity, you begin with the world, with intersubjectivity. Husserl, in his later work, arguably addressed some of these problems, particularly the notion of the life world, that we all inhabit a life world. But they are still there in his work. Okay, then, what's the application of this kind of thing to texts? I don't know if anyone got to have a look at it. There was Ed Hirsch was a literary critic at University of Virginia who's still alive, who argues that what's important is author's intention, the intention of the author. And he applied a phenomenological Husserlian kind of model to understanding this. So he thought, first of all, that study or analysis of text is about getting to the author's intention. We'll look at his argument in a minute. And that's contrasted with a different view, that the author's intention is irretrievable, which we'll be looking at next time, and that meaning exceeds intention. And you have the idea that the death of the author, which has become quite famous, which we'll be looking at next time. So I want to raise questions before we look at Ed Hirsch's argument about, can we apply the phenomenological model to sacred texts, especially in terms of noesis and noema? It's quite interesting when you use those categories with relation to texts. Actually, I did this with a colleague in Virginia, actually. We looked at one of the Upanishads, that we had our own Aryaka Upanishad, in terms of these categories. And the students did, really. And it was a text that lends itself very easily to kind of phenomenological analysis. It was the beginning of that text. I don't know if you remember it, but it's about, it's death. It was a question of what comes first, and I think whether death is first or not. And a question, at one point somebody asks, what is the self of death? What is the essence of death? What is the self of death? And it's such an Indian question, that, isn't it? And it's very interesting when you apply the noesis noema kind of model, the object of consciousness and the method of understanding that to those kind of, use that as a lens through which to analyse that text, which the students did in Virginia. Very interesting. We actually thought also that the biblical texts were resistant to that kind of analysis. We thought that was very interesting, and that biblical texts, we thought, were more amenable to a semiotic analysis than the phenomenological one. Now, whether that says something about the nature of the text, I don't know. Well, we thought it did. Anyway, okay. So, can we apply phenomenological model to sacred texts? What could we mean by intentionality in a sacred text, i.e. whose intentionality? I mean, a theological claim is that the intentionality of the subject of intentionality of the text is arguably some transcendent source, the author. And what are the limits of the phenomenology in understanding a sacred text? So the general kind of questions that we might like to raise. Any points at this point before we go on? No, okay, let's have a look at Ed Hirsch. I think I said I was going to photocopy it, didn't I? But I'm afraid I didn't, I'm so sorry. But I can photocopy, I can do one copy after this. So this is Ed Hirsch's argument, particularly the notion of objective interpretation. We can discuss this as we go through it. Some theory argues for the inseparability of description and evaluation in a text meaning. Sorry, some theory argues for the inseparability of description and evaluation in a text meaning is simply its meaning to us today. Some theory argues for the inseparability of description and evaluation, and a text meaning is simply its meaning for us today. Right, so what's meaning about a text? The meaning, what's important about a text is meaning for us. So Paul Ricoeur comes along and says all texts are equal before me, regardless of their historical depth.
Do you have another one?
Sorry, no, I haven't, I'm afraid.
Mine is pure interest, that's all.
I could do another one.
Is this one back?
Yeah, it's on the back, yeah.
He's got it.
But we have two distinct objects. The object of interpretation is textual meaning in and for itself, i.e. the meaning of the text. And the object of criticism is that meaning and its bearing on something else, the significance of the text. That's okay, I think. And that meaning and significance distinction, he says, is clarified by Frege. and he relates that to Husserl's general distinction between inner and outer horizon of any meaning. So Frege's distinction, the sense and reference, anyone know about that? Sinn und Bedeutung. Do you know it? No, it's Frege in 1890 or something said that you can distinguish between the sense of a word and its reference, which is obvious meaning in a way, obvious in a way, isn't it? That the meaning of a word, you can understand the meaning of a word without understanding its reference, with the reference, so you can get the same reference with different words, different sentences for the same reference. So there's a variability of reference, of sense. So the meaning of a sentence could be distinguished from its reference. And Husserl, Hirsch relates that to Husserl's, makes the distinction between the inner and the outer horizon of any meaning. The inner horizon of meaning is open to description through the bracketing process, and the outer horizon is that is the reference, I suppose. The outer horizon is the question of, I'm putting words in Husserl's mouth here, but it's the question of truth, the boundary, the limits of the possibility of appearances. And in his later work, he actually says that the ultimate limit, the ultimate outer horizon is time. Temporality is the ultimate outer horizon of meaning. And he wrote a very important book, actually, Husserl did earlier, called The Phenomenology of Inner Time Consciousness, which Levinas writes about, which Derrida writes about. It's a very key text, in which he talks about protensions and retensions that we project into the future. And time is very complex. Inner time is quite a complex phenomenon, according to Husserl, because of this idea of protensions, projection into the future, and this retention from the past, which forms the present. Okay, let's move on with... There are two horizons, then, of textual meaning. And there's a fusion, according to Husserl, between interpretation of a text and criticism or critique of the text. And he says that there is this because textual meaning changes over time. Did anyone actually read it? I don't suppose you did, because I didn't do copies. Oh, you did? Oh, terrific. Yeah. Okay, so if there's a fusion of interpretation and criticism, he doesn't want that. Ed Hirsch wants to separate them out because he's a phenomenologist, so he wants interpretation and criticism to be separated out. But if true, there could be no objective knowledge of text to fuse meaning and significance or interpretation and criticism by changing autonomous meaning destroys the basis for agreement and objective study. So if you... A text, then, through time, the meaning of a text changes through time, is one possibility. But while Ed Hirsch accepts that to some extent, he never says, nevertheless, there's an objective meaning to the text. The text was written by an author who intended a certain meaning. And the object of interpretation is to get at the authorial intention and the true meaning of the text. So he's got this notion of the true meaning of the text. So, in the Upanishads, you are that, Tattvamasi. When Madhva comes along and says, Tattvamnasi, you are not that, that's going away from the true meaning of the text in Hirsch's view. It's not a legitimate interpretation. So he's got this thing, textual meaning, then, he says, is the verbal intention of the author. But the verbal intention of the author, curiously, Hirsch says, must not be identified with the author, or indeed the reader, psychic acts. I must admit, I'm not lucidly clear what he means by that. It's not the psychic acts that are important, but the intentional meaning. So he wants to get away from it. He doesn't want it to be reduced to psychology. So the meaning is in the text, but it's almost as if the intentionality of the author is projected into the text itself. So that through analysing the text, you're getting at the author's intentionality, without reference to the psychic states of the author.
But then how can it be? Because the state of the, put it in a very basic clinical way, the mental state of the person in many ways expresses the thoughts, decides the thought processes, which in turn is transferred as a text. So by reading the text, one can get into the mental state of the individual.
Yeah.
I mean, the Beck's way of looking at Picasso's painting, or the blue period, so on so forth, at this time he was completely mad. This time he had a migraine headache.
Mm.
We are, in a way, looking at it from his text.
Yeah, I think Hirsch would agree with that, but he would say it's not, like in the case of Picasso, you still see the subjectivity in the, but it's not in Picasso, it's in the text. I think that's what the point that he's making, that say Picasso's dead. But nevertheless, the intentionality of Picasso remains in the painting. I think he would say that.
I also think he might be trying to wrest some of the control away from the author, rather than the author having this, the psychic intention. You know, this means this.
Yeah.
I think he's saying that that's not what intention here is.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
the author making the decision.
Yeah.
But it is derived from the author.
Yeah.
Like it's like probably of the text rather than of the author.
That's right. That's key. It's a property of the text rather than the author. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I think that's what he means. So it's actually moving away from the Schleiermacherian thing that we looked at briefly last week, which was the one of the objects of hermeneutics interpretation of the psychology, the psychic, the inner state of the author. So it's wanting to put everything in the outside in the text, as it were, but nevertheless wanting to keep hold of the notion of authorial intention. And so it's not wanting to get rid of the author, it's wanting to allow the author to keep hold of the text and to control its outcomes. So it becomes objective, as it were. And he makes this distinction in that article, in the book, between intentional act, which he calls noesis, and the intentional object, which is noema, which are Husserlian terms. And different intentional acts can intend an identical intentional object, which is related to that Sinn und Bedeutung distinction we mentioned earlier. So different readings. Okay, you've got the same text. And we read the same text next week. That's a different occasion we're reading it on. That's a different intentional act with the same intentional object. So repeated readings of the same text will be the same intentional object, but different readings of it, which are different intentional acts. And we need to posit, says Ed Hirsch, a general horizon of a text's meaning, i.e. its genre, like novel or whatever, actual history, fiction. And the horizon concept, which again he gets from Husserl, defines the norms and limits which bound the meaning represented by a text. So if you read a fairy story, the question of, well, that's not true, is almost the question of the truth or falseness of a fairy story is not appropriate within the genre of the text. So likewise, do we extend this to religious texts? So to what extent, say that the story of biblical stories, or story of the, say something in the Upanishads, Nachiketas goes to the house of death, and a historian asks, oh, when did he do that? What day was it? That's an inappropriate question to bring to bear to that text. What did he have for supper that day? You know, it's a misunderstanding of the genre. So there are certain kinds of questions which arguably are excluded or should be excluded from the text. I don't know. But on the other hand, if you do cross over, if you apply the questions that you ask in one genre to another genre, that's often very stimulating, very exciting, and you get interesting things developing. So to treat, I mean, Gopal, you may have dealt with this on your course. So if to treat, say, a religious text in the same way that you would treat a scientific thesis or something, so is you. On this account, that's a mixture. That's confusing genres, and it's applying questions appropriate to one genre to another genre. So the horizon. What's the horizon of the genre? You have to specify the horizon in order to. There are some kinds of questions a text just can't deal with, or you can't legitimately ask it to answer those questions. You're asking too much of it. Okay, then determinateness of textual meaning. If textual meaning is verbal intention of the author, then hermeneutics is a reconstruction of the author's aims in order to develop guidance for constructing the meaning of the text. That's fairly fundamental. Therefore, a text is more than just a piece of language. That's his criticism of the kind of the incipient semiotics and postmodern criticism that he is developing when he's writing this. Text is just language, intertextuality is all just language. He says, no, a language is more than just, a text is more than just a piece of language. If text is simply a piece of language, then correct interpretation is impossible. And he wants to maintain that correct interpretation is impossible. What's the horizon of correct interpretation? Authorial intention expressed in the text. So you can have a true meaning of a text and you can have a wrong interpretation, wrong understanding of a text, which you assess by reference to the objective intentional meaning within the text, authorial intention within the text.
I wonder if he refers to the eidos, the essence of phenomenon.
He might do. I don't remember if he does in the
it seems to be the real meaning of the text might be what he means as an essence of the textual phenomenon.
Good point, yeah. So the essence of the text is the authorial intention, yeah, which you can understand through, well, presumably repeated meanings. Oh, yeah, that's right. So you've got his earlier intentional acts and the intentional object, which is authorial intention, the noema, has as its deeper structure the eidos. That's right, that's a good point. And you've got different intentional acts which access it on different occasions. Perhaps the repeated readings of a text, you more clearly intuit the eidos, the essence of the text.
Perhaps it is much more relevant for the scriptures rather than other type of texts.
So repeated readings, you get to know the text, you intuit the essence more and more, or something like that. That's very interesting. You can if you, If the eidos is the intentional, is the authorial intention, and that is the object of inquiry.
This for me raises a problem in terms of Hindu scriptural texts, because whether the Upanishads or the Vedic texts actually are regarded as not having a human author. So the only intentionality we can look at is the Bhashyams, that is the commentaries. So the text, we have no understanding of what the intention was. I mean, it, the simple thing as the Bhagavad Gita, it has got so many Bhashyas, we have no understanding of what the intention was of the original author.
Yes.
It is attributed to a particular person, whatever.
So you have a Mimamsaka who would say, the Veda, this is in Vedic Hindu scriptures, the Mimamsaka say they have no author, they're authorless. So they have no beginning. So where's the intentionality there?
It's gone completely. You cannot have even a hermeneutic analysis either. All of that can only be applied to the Bhashyakaras.
And is he talking about a historical author here, or is he just kind of talking about some sort of mental construction that we use to understand the text? That's what I'm confused about, and I think so. Even if there is no, you know, historical author or author that we talk about, you can still kind of construct this, you know, this thought experiment of some meaning behind that was constructed that we can get at.
Yes.
But I don't know if that's what he's saying.
I think that may be behind what he's saying. This Russian thinker, Bakhtin, made that distinction. There's a historical author of the text, and what he calls the author, or what other thinkers call the narrator, is the author within the text, is the subject of intentionality within the text itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'd have to have a reread of it. What did you think?
I think
on that question.
I was working on the assumption that this method of textual sort of interpretation depends completely on Husserl's subject-object relationship. And
yeah.
I think when later on, when that relationship is critiqued and disrupted by Derrida, Heidegger, others.
Yeah.
When the subject is no longer an autonomous liberal self,
yeah.
That's when there's real problems. And I think, I'm not from the Hindu tradition, so I can't say regarding your scriptures, or the holy text, the sacred text. But I think one way to look at it might be that because the authorial intention is not there, because our goal is not to reconstruct the object of his or her intentionality, the text is freed and sort of liberated, and that it's allowed to come forth and appear to us in a way that may be even more powerful and sort of transcendent than if we were sort of limited to the very hard, the imperial sort of object, imposed on us by the author.
Yeah.
You know, we're allowed to. I think Husserl put himself on a slippery slope when he talked about appearances. Heidegger and Derrida pick up on this, that metaphysics is put on is endangered, and now we simply have phenomena.
Yeah.
And
Yep.
if we can confront those primordially and sort of firsthand, I think that might even be more powerful than sitting around trying to construct intentionality.
Yeah. So what's the signifiers of freed of their signifieds?
That's scary, and I know, Derrida's critique, but it's also maybe
liberating.
Also liberating.
Yeah.
It just depends.
We go into that line next week, really, doesn't it? Yeah. So, is it that you've got... You've got the historical author, let's call it historical author, and you've got the text, the concrete text, and then you've got the author in the text, let's call it the textual author, and that's so. Is Ed Hirsch saying that talking about the limit of the meaning of the text being this, which is actually divorced from the historical author? That's your point. Yeah, and I think that's probably the case. I'd have to reread it carefully. But certainly other thinkers like Bakhtin and so on said, when I say the author, this is what I mean, not this. So even in the Veda, in a sense, you could say that there's a narrator of the text or a textual author, regardless of the theological claim about the existence or non-existence of the historical author. And the other thing that's related to this is the text-work distinction. Is the text, the historical text, an instance, historical instantiation, material instantiation of something called the work, which is the kind of the Hirschian line would be. So which I suppose the work is almost identified with the authorial intention. So you get Melville's Moby Dick, and you get the different versions of Melville's text, and then you try and construct authorial intention from it, and you get to the work, which is independent of its instantiations. Something like that. So he says, therefore, a text is not just a piece of language, then, that's his point. But to say that textual meaning is determinate is not to say it's not complex, but only to insist that a text meaning is what it is, and not 100 other things. Also, author's text might not represent the parole he desired to convey. So he's destroying that speech-language distinction. Yeah, we'll talk about that next time. And problem verification. A reader can never be certain that his or indeed her readings are correct. So the criteria for establishing correct readings are, one, legitimacy. To establish a reading is as probable, it is necessary to show that it's possible. The reading must be permissible within the public norms of long language structure, the objective language structure, as it were, in which the text was composed. Yeah, so the readings must be permissible within the boundary, the horizon of the language itself, grammar, for example. Correspondence, reading must account for each linguistic component of the text. Okay. Generic appropriateness, a genre, the appropriateness of the text of a particular genre, a particular style. Coherence, if a text does not meet the previous three, oh I see, then it's not coherent. So we needn't speak about what a text says, but what an author means. So this is point. This is to put forth a wholehearted and self-critical effort at the primary level of criticism, the level of understanding. So he's against interpretation and for criticism in a sense. And criticism is about getting an authorial intention. An interpretation implies a potentially endless series of understandings of the text, which Ed Hirsch thinks we shouldn't do, because there's an objectivity to it which you can access through the noesis of phenomenology. But this raises problems, you know.
I was going to say a thing, because it, again, in Hinduism, this raises a major problem. Because if something is an oral tradition and everything is condensed to the basic required words, then actual translation and interpretation can have totally different... It begins to rely on interpretation as opposed to translation. And that's one I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Or you even say one of the things like the Brahma Sutra. The whole thing is very few words, short, pithy statements.
Sure.
But unless you have some kind of interpretive ability, you can't get to the meaning of what is
right.
being said.
Right.
So
you
this
have
application
to have a certain
becomes
adhikara,
very
you
difficult
to, yeah.
when you try to apply to a lot of the, I mean, one of the Prasthanatraya texts itself.
Yeah.
That was what the doubt was getting into my head.
Very interesting. It's very interesting when you look at those Ed Hirsch's kind of argument in relation to something like the Veda, which is supposed to be apparushya and all the rest of it. It's very interesting. But we'll pick up the problems of all of this next time. I think we've got 5 minutes actually. For next time, I said we could look at Kristeva's Revolution in Poetic Language. I think I've slightly changed my mind about that, because it's quite heavy going, that text, and it might be better to read something more general. A very good... I always think, even though it's very old now, Colours, the Pursuit of Signs is a good text. So if you read something on semiotics, perhaps by Barthes, he wrote a short book called Theory of Semiotics. And there's this book, The Semiotic Challenge. In which there's some interesting articles, particularly there's a structural analysis of narrative of Acts 10 to 11. There's also an analysis of Genesis 32, 23 to 33, wrestling with the angel, a textual analysis of Genesis, which is a very interesting text. I thought we might like to read that. But I don't feel pressurized to read it, but if you've got time, but just turn up. But if you can mean something general on semiotics, perhaps from colour. And we may get on to Kristeva. But if you can have a look at Wrestling with the Angel, it's a quite an interesting article in this book. And I think I might use that as a basis for our discussion next time and do a kind of summary of that article. A one sheet summary. Okay. We can read Kristeva if you're burning to read Kristeva. Anyway. It's her first book, Revolution in Poetic Language, about the core, about some basic kind of energy in the world, in the text. So, see you next week then.
I borrowed this from you, so I just wanted to
get
back.
Oh, of course, yeah. Thanks very much. The Friday thing, I think, was when I was coming.
I can't make it this term, I'm sorry, but maybe next time.
See you next time. Bye-bye, see you soon. Thanks, Judy.
For what?
For you.
Going to eat something and then.
Yeah, and then I said I better give it to you later. That's lovely, please. That won't help you at all. Not you.
I'll put him on the list then.
Yes, please. You add him to the list as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I have it 5 pounds. I'll find
it. I have to cash it, so I can give him 5 back.
Where the heck I put it?
I can give you 5 back. Doesn't matter. Really. Doesn't matter.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Where did I find the 10 pounds? Because I'm here to
touch.
There. There's the 10 pounds.
So
that's
for
Dr.
Rajan.
Dr. Rajan.
Okay.
As well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Hello. What is today? Today is Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Thursday.
Tomorrow, you're not coming for lunch tomorrow?
No, I've got to go to the hospital again.
They've got
some checkups to do, so I can't.
Okay.
See you then.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
from that? For Shanika, he's gone.
Shanika. I just saw him around.
Oh,
I know you were there. Okay. Me
yeah.
too?
Yeah.
Yeah, just can
yeah,
you
go
give me 10 seconds
yeah,
before
no.
I forget. I just look at someone else.
We
have these stamps.
Do we?
Yeah, you don't
I
have
to.
That
it's
okay. What was it? Just to post these. Yeah.
Is that okay? If it's trouble,
yeah,
then
yeah.
I can try and put it.
Why would it be trouble?
Stephanie,
when I'm going home
I'm sure
at night, I just pop them.
Part of the reason I give it to you is partly because stamps and partly because
yeah,
I forget.
Yeah.
And then what happens is that this has happened so many times.
It's okay.
3 weeks later, so
it's okay.
It's dirty and weird. So that's that part.
Uh-huh.
Little question.
Uh-huh.
You gave me some forms, like you gave me Bobbit Buckle or Sparty
Buckle
form. Are there any more forms?
Yeah, I was just going to give you.
Okay.
Yeah, but I just have
but
to think it over first what I'm doing and
that's
what
fine.
You're doing.
That's
it's been sitting here for.
I have exactly
time.
The same feeling all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Completely.
Yeah,
every time
yeah.
I get something, I'm like,
yeah.
Let me think about
it. Yeah, who's doing this part? Who's doing this?
No,
yeah.
No, exactly.
We'll get into it.
Okay,
we'll get into
it. As long as I'm vaguely there. Another question.
Mm-hmm.
Shanka and I noticed that for Oxford, Shanka noticed, I didn't notice.
Mm-hmm.
Is this one, we've been giving students two different forms. So some of them.
Oh, this is level
Jessica.
Two. This is not level. This is level one. Not level two.
Mm.
It's only the that second Bhagavad Gita.
Mm.
It's Lester and Harrow only. That's level two. Lester one.
That's right. Because
Lester
one
and Harrow.
This is
Harrow
okay.
two.
The question is, I think you printed these ones out. And
yeah.
I've printed some out. We're printing for two different places, I think. Because there is a form. Where did you get these ones from, do you think?
Continuing education.
Yeah.
No forms. Oh, I've found CD distribution.
Okay,
this
cool.
is copied here from the CD.
Okay, cool.
So you don't have to open the CD.
Yes.
And
well,
module okay. registration, and just fill it in.
Okay, the reason I ask is because
yeah.
if possible, if we go back up, can we get them from now? And this isn't very helpful with me, but the way I'm doing it, rather than look for everything everywhere and all the different folders
yeah.
and figure it out, all the stuff that I'm working with is
okay.
2067, so if you go in there...
So you make up the forms for every...
Exactly.
And you have a different... So you save them and you don't have to write them up.
Yeah, let me just make sure I know where they are. So it should be that Oxford, if you try there... No, go up.
Up.
Oh, no, back to
yeah.
there, yeah. Where are we? Calendar schedule correspondence.
Students.
Student forms, that's it. So then there'll be one that says Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
from now on, if we print them up, because that
yeah,
one
yeah.
should be accurate.
What did I do?
I think
so
it isn't. All you did was print it from the other file, from the original file that we've been printing it up.
Yeah, but
forever.
Was anything wrong with
yeah.
that?
It's okay, these are wrong.
What?
They're only wrong insofar as they say level two, but I think mine do as well. And
this is not for yeah, this is not for Oxford, obviously. Did I print this out?
I think so.
Really?
Because this is what Shanika said. Some of the students had handed back ones that
sorry,
said that.
No.
No, it's fine. It's fine. And also because we want them. Some of them say Anu and Nick.
And
some
and
of them say Anu
doctor. And I.
No.
It wasn't me because it did put
doctor. Really?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
it. Well, maybe I think it might have been him actually. But
yeah.
in any case, we want them all to say Anu and Nick.
Yeah?
Yeah, because the teachers change for all of them. We should just put
them.
Well, this thing, but apparently Shanika's concerned that they need to be the same. It doesn't matter that they
oh,
do
really?
Need to be the
there's
same.
Always Anu and Nick.
So, yeah, exactly. So some of them are a bit different.
Okay.
Can you really quickly for me? Just look at that mm-hmm. Oxford one. We go down. Okay, so that one is okay. Anu and Nick, another one. Okay, good. Okay, so as long as
no,
we...
No, you would these ones.
Yeah, if that's okay, that would be great.
I was always so careful to check what I put on it.
No. I think you're probably right. That man is so addicted to blaming stuff on us. And then he laughs if you can't figure it out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's not, it's not nice to put the plane back.
Yeah, exactly.
All those foods going to get
sweet. I don't need to, I'll just tell you this incidentally as we're going along. And some of these forms, let me just look. I don't want to mix them up, but I just want to look at them. Module form, that's a module form. Any of the student forms? Yeah, that's it. The student form comes in two parts, right? Student application form.
Yeah, two bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's the second page. And a lot of people are forgetting to sign this bit.
Oh, really?
So if you see, maybe you'll just notice it.
Yeah, okay. Okay, good point.
I think that's the only thing. Maybe it's actually, maybe it's only just
one. Well, we have to send them back? Or
one or two we'll have to send back.
Yeah.
We'll just get them to print it out and send it.
It's such a pain. I know it's going to be such a pain.
Yes, it is. It drives me crazy. Every time. I think it's simple.
Yeah, I think it's simple and stuff.
Okay, and that's all.
I'll give these to you.
Thank you.
I'll try to do it today.
Please do it today.
Yeah? You need it today.
I don't
do it.
Okay. Don't give me anything.
Okay, I won't.
Thank you.
Oh. I left my things in there, so.
Sorry.
I left my things in there, so I'll wait till you can go.
Shall I get them?
No.
Come and get them.
Okay.
Meeting of the traffic.